Greetings, everybody. This is David Avocado Wolf, and we are gearing up for an incredible longevity conference in Anaheim, California. That's right next to Disneyland. And this year's conference, April 24th through 26, 2015, is going to be held at the Anaheim Hilton. And to me, this is one of the greatest venues in all of Southern California, and maybe the very best for an event like this. You'll be joining us and 2,000 other people there at that event. So check out all the details at longevityconference.com. One of the amazing speakers and amazing intellects, writers, and doctors who will be joining us at that conference is Dr. Lissa Rankin. She's a mind-body medicine physician. She's founder of the Whole Health Medicine Institute training program that's for physicians and other healthcare providers. She's a New York Times best-selling author of Mind Over Medicine, which you may have read. An incredible book. And it gets right into her core mission, which is to put care back into healthcare and heal our broken healthcare system, one doctor and one patient at a time. Her new book is called The Fear Cure. I've read it. I'm not sure if it's out in the market yet, but I've read it. And with no further ado, welcome Dr. Lissa Rankin. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, you've had several popular TED Talks. You've been all over the speaking circuit with Mind Over Medicine. But The Fear Cure was really a good book. That to me was actually even better than Mind Over Medicine and got more to the core of the things that I'm interested in. Tell us a little bit about how you got to The Fear Cure. Tell us a little bit maybe about your journey leading up to it and then the content of it, which I thought was extraordinary. It's one of the best books in alternative healing I've ever read.
Oh, thank you. Well, I have two answers for that question. I could give you the, the validated, press-friendly answer. I could give you the truth.
Our listeners want the truth. We are, right. I think, the cutting edge of alternative medicine in terms of what our interests are, and all the folks listening right now, I'm really excited to hear an unedited version.
Okay, I'll give you the unedited version, and I'll just frame it with the other one, which is that, you know, because I'm a physician, when I entered the world of publishing, everybody wanted to kind of put me in this doctor box. Like, you're a doctor, we want you to get up on a pedestal and say smart things and, you know, contribute to the field of health in a fresh way. And, you know, I could do that. But the reality was that what I wrote about in The Fear Cure and in the book of mine that comes out next year called The Anatomy of a Calling is what I was really interested in after I quit my job in conventional medicine in 2007, which is really the intersection of spirituality and health. And in the beginning, there was a lot of resistance. People don't want a doctor going out and talking about spirituality for reasons I don't understand, given that there are people like Deepak Chopra in the world who, you know, have been doing this for years. But there was a lot of resistance around that. So Mind Over Medicine was kind of a compromise. And it was a very strategic compromise to kind of start hinting towards my interest in the sort of spiritual underpinnings of disease and the capacity for spiritual healing of the body. But what I realized in writing Mind Over Medicine, you know, it sort of teaches these six steps to healing yourself, which is really a spiritual approach to healing the body. But what I realized I had sort of failed to address in Mind Over Medicine is based on this model that I was using with my patients where they're writing the prescription for themselves. It's basically an intuitively guided plan, action plan for how to bring your life back into alignment with your truth, with your true essence. And when I say that, I mean sort of who you are when all of the layers of what you aren't, or, you know, all of those layers of ego, of fear, of all that isn't you, your spirit. So what I realized is that you can be as intuitive as you want and really tune into, you know, what is your body saying no to? What does your body need in order to heal? And you can create this prescription for yourself. But if you're too afraid to implement it, it doesn't make any difference. You know, then you know, but you're not actually changing it. So you're not going to get the outcome that you're looking at. So I realized that sort of the sequel to Mind Over Medicine needed to address something larger, but it's really, it's really not about mind over medicine at all, in that The Fear Cure is absolutely its own independent book written not just for patients, but for anybody who feels like fear is getting in the way of their full, true expression of who they are and what their purpose on life is about. So the beginning of The Fear Cure was, it was quite a journey writing this book. Like, if you ever are arrogant enough to think that you're going to write a book called The Fear Cure, get ready to get your butt kicked.
Did you feel a lot of fear writing The Fear Cure?
Oh my God. Well, honestly, like, the beginning of The Fear Cure was really easy. It was kind of like writing Mind Over Medicine Part 2, because it's all about the scientific data proving that fear is not just an uncomfortable emotion that makes us feel bad or gets in the way, but that it's actually predisposing us to cancer, you know, heart disease, the common cold even. So it's all the scientific data that was easy to write, you know, all the physiology of fear. And but what I wasn't thinking about was like, oh geez, now I've just made people more afraid. So now I've made them more afraid. I have to give them something. What in the world am I going to give them? So I literally had severe writer's block for about a year and a half. I tried to give back the money and give back my advance and cancel the project. And my agent, bless her heart, was so supportive. And she kept saying, Lissa, like, I'm happy to support you no matter what. But all I can say, because I kept saying, who am I to write a book about fear? I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a spiritual teacher. Like, I'm a doctor. What do I know about fear? And she said, all I can say is that every time I talk to you, I feel less afraid. And if it weren't for my mentor, Rachel Naomi Remen, who I spent 2 months literally sitting at her proverbial kitchen table, she wrote a book called Kitchen Table Wisdom, I could not have written this book. But what somehow miraculously, on the other side of all of my fear of trying to write a book like this, I got this download about kind of what causes fear in our culture. It's cultural. It's a choice. It's not the truth. It's just a cultural set of beliefs. And I realized that there's a way to transform these beliefs and literally free ourselves from the cage of fear by letting fear transmute us. So in other words, it's not about curing fear. It's about letting fear cure you, like using fear as a guidepost towards everything in need of healing in your life, not just to heal the body, but to open the soul cage to allow your true self to walk out and step into its purpose.
That sounded a lot like, it reminded me of Carlos Castaneda's angle of using death as your teacher.
Yes, exactly.
So to get you into action and to get you moving. Now let's talk about this thing about fear, because it, to me, I remember when we first talked about this, when we were at the Women's Wellness Conference, you and I were having a discussion, and you were talking about the cultural nature of fear in our world, like in our westernized world. And there's so much fear. I mean, I started going, wow, there's fear all over TV. There is fear in every news broadcast. And so I started going, what is going on culturally that is just this like fear-mongering? It seems like it's a very westernized concept.
Well, this gets off on a whole other subject, but a lot of it revolves around our economy. I mean, there's an entire industry of fear. I mean, just look at advertising in the media, just that one specific industry. It's all based on making you afraid that you're not going to be good enough unless you buy whatever it is they want you to buy so you belong. Like, we have this deep yearning to belong to something greater than ourselves, and we think we're going to be able to buy our way into it. But it's beyond that. I mean, I wrote a whole chapter in The Fear Cure that I ended up cutting because it was sort of a cul-de-sac, but it's near and dear to my heart, which was all about fear and healthcare and how much money we spend in the healthcare industry in the United States alone just based on fear, on the doctor's fear that they're going to miss something and get sued or that somebody's going to die on their hands, and the patient's fear that something's going to get missed and they might die. Once again, is going back to that fear of death, right? And how much that fear of death, or in the case of healthcare, the fear of missing something, the fear of judgment, the fear of being wrong, the fear of malpractice suits, the fear of pain, all of these things lead us to order tests that aren't necessary, that are expensive, that are leading to overdiagnosis and overtreatment. All of the screening tests that are leading us to diagnose cancers early, cancers that would have gone away on their own if they had been untreated. I mean, it's you start to open Pandora's box when you start to look into this subject, and there are a whole lot of people in the culture that do not want us to get over our fear, that depend on our fear for the way the economy is set up.
Let me ask you this question, because I felt like a big change has come over American society in the last couple of years, and it's right in the timing of your book. I mean, I think a great book kind of predicts something that's occurring culturally. And it's the boy who cried wolf syndrome, where, and the Ebola is a really good example of this. It was like fear, 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 Ebola, fear, fear, fear. And the people suddenly were like, you know what? No, we're not buying it. And just it fizzled. The whole Ebola thing fizzled out. And all of a sudden it was like everybody's starting to take to this boy who cried wolf kind of story of like, look, we're kind of done with this whole fear story. That I think what you're tapping into is culturally a change that's occurring, you know, at a real deep level. And I think it is this boy who cried wolf syndrome. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, David. And it actually gives me a tremendous amount of hope. It's very exciting to me that even in the amount of time since I started writing this book, it's like we need this book less now than we did when I started to write it. And that I find incredibly hopeful. You know, because there is this shift in consciousness that's underway. And I think, you know, I think when the culture is serving people's needs, when we feel like it's working, then we're much less motivated to change it. And when we get to a point where it becomes clear to the majority that the story of our culture is, you know, it's becoming extinct. It's not working. You know, all of the cultural beliefs that we have been buying since, really, when you look at it, since the 1950s, where there was this whole notion that the world is working because science is going to figure everything out. And the politicians are going to take care of us, and the bankers are going to help us make more money so we can buy big houses. And all of these assumptions that we make about the culture, again, largely based on the economy, that all of our solutions are going to be solved and we're going to grow and expand as a species and things are just going to keep getting better. You know, that was something that people really believed. And then the Cold War came and, you know, a whole series of things started to unfold. And I think more and more people are realizing, wow, this way of living doesn't work. It's not making us happy. It's not making us healthy. And now it's not even making us rich. You know? At least for a while, it was making us rich, right? At one point, my house was making more money than I was. You know, every year it doubled in value. It was great. I was like, wow, I don't even have to work. I own a house. Well, now I don't own a house anymore. And it's, you know, it's all of those kinds of stories have started to dismantle for almost everybody. And, you know, I think we're starting to question the beliefs that I wrote about in The Fear Cure, which I think really a lot of our cultural fears stem from what I called four fearful assumptions.
That's really incredible stuff. That's really at the core of your book. And by the way, if you're just tuning in right now, Dr. Lissa Rankin and I are having a conversation about her book, The Fear Cure, which begins with her bang. That's what happened to you in that tunnel on the side of the road. I'm not going to say what that is, but what a great beginning to a book. But then you drive at these like four core courageous truths and get into that. I think that's really incredible stuff.
Yeah. So, when I sat down and I was really meditating, I mean, thank God for my meditation practice, because again, if it weren't for Rachel Naomi Remen and my meditation practice, I wouldn't have known how to write this book. But I kept getting sort of these epiphanies and insights. And one of them was, okay, why are we so afraid? Like never in human history have we had more reason to feel safe. And yet we've never been more afraid. I mean, climate change aside, and that's a big aside, but you know, we've never had better medicine. We've never had more money. The infant mortality rate has never been lower. Like all the big things that might make us afraid, we've managed a lot of them. And yet we have these beliefs, I think. They're a huge part of the culture, but it's only our culture. It's not everywhere. And this, you know, David, you and I were talking about this when we saw each other last, about what a huge epiphany it was for me to go and stay at a village with the Caros at 16,000 feet in the Andes. And it was right after I'd finished writing The Fear Cure. And I realized that these four fearful assumptions that I'm about to tell you all, they don't have them. And they automatically have the other set of beliefs that I'm going to tell you about. And they're much less afraid, even though you might look at their lives and think they have a lot more reason to be afraid. They're much more at risk of illness, death, you know, the elements, predators, these kinds of things.
Lightning.
Exactly, lightning. But they're much less afraid. So these four fearful assumptions, and for those of you listening, I just want you to really listen. I'm going to read them slowly so you can really digest whether this is a belief that you have. One is that uncertainty is unsafe. One is, I can't handle losing what I cherish. One is, it's a dangerous world, so I have to protect myself. And the other is, I'm all alone. So you can imagine, if you believe that you're all alone in a hostile universe where you're at risk of losing what you cherish, and uncertainty is the gateway to everything terrifying, that on the other side of what you don't know is likely to be bad stuff, right? If you believe that, no wonder you're afraid. But I've been a student of Byron Katie's work for many years, and she teaches a process called The Work that's essentially taking beliefs that are creating suffering in your life and questioning them. And she has a whole process that's four questions and what she calls the turnaround. And essentially her questions are, is the belief true? Is it really true? How do you feel when you believe that that's true? And who would you be, or how would you feel without that belief? And if it's creating suffering for you, what might feel more true? So I did that process on these beliefs. And what I came up with was what I called the four courage cultivating truths. And so these are their opposite. And I'm going to read those slowly too, just so you can see how that sits with you, how it feels if these were your beliefs. Uncertainty is the gateway to possibility. Loss is natural and can lead to growth. It's a purposeful universe, that everything that happens, even if you don't understand why, is happening for a reason. And we're not all alone, we're all one. So you can see that if you believe that we're all interconnected, that we're part of a web of something larger than ourselves, that we're connected to each other as humans, we're connected to the plants, to the animals, to the wind, to the ocean, to the mountains, that everything that happens to us, even loss, even things that we might be frightened of, that they're happening as part of our soul's evolution, that it's kind of our soul's curriculum during this life. And that uncertainty isn't something that we need to avoid, because when we don't know, and this is a huge switch for people. I remember when this happened to me, when I used to wake up every morning not knowing what the future held. This was after I'd quit my job. I was $200,000 in debt. My husband wasn't working. I had a newborn. All of my dreams and all my efforts to kind of fulfill a dream were not working. By all evidence, it looked like I was going to like miserably fail, and I was going to miserably fail publicly because I had this blog that a lot of people were reading. Every morning I would wake up feeling terrified, like, what in the world is going to happen today? What bad thing is going to happen today? And one day I woke up and this switch was underway, and I started realizing, I don't know what today holds, which means anything could happen. Wonderful things could happen today. And, you know, as long as we need to know, then we're not open to mystery and wonder and awe. And ever since I opened that door, that uncertainty could be the gateway to possibility, all kinds of mysterious, wondrous, awe-inspiring things have begun to happen. And this shift in my beliefs has made me significantly less afraid. And these are the beliefs that the Caros, that the indigenous people of Peru, these are the beliefs that many of these indigenous tribes hold as their worldview. And it was wonderful to get that validation, to see like, wow, this is what it looks like. And I got to witness how this tribe managed the loss of a baby and all of the incredible support that was offered to this woman, and the belief that loss is natural and can lead to growth, the belief that this baby came from Pachamama, from Mother Earth, and Pachamama took her back, and that this was part of the natural order of things, that it was a purposeful universe. And as much as they were grieving the loss of this child, that they had a larger perspective on it that allowed for such things to be part of that natural order. And instead of resisting the reality of the loss of this child, they accepted it. And it was a whole different thing. I mean, having lost babies in a hospital, I mean, what happens to us in our culture when somebody loses a baby? I mean, it's horrible, right? It's like these women that lose a child sometimes never recover. They spend the rest of their lives afraid of everything because, you know, they've lost the thing that they most cherish and they feel like they can't handle it. So it was, the whole process of kind of recognizing this was a huge epiphany for me.
That story about the Caro people is really interesting because many of these things that you're talking about, for example, loss is natural and leads to growth. That's such a deeply ingrained part of the Caro way of life, and that the universe has purpose and uncertainty is the gateway to possibility. And what's interesting about the Caro people is not only the way they deal with death, but the way they deal with life. They're the longest lived people. I put their longevity up against any race of people in the world.
I met the oldest woman in their village. They're not exactly sure how old she is, but they think she's 111. And she was amazing. She's still making these intricate weavings. I was like, wow, how is she doing this? She's got cataracts. So I'm looking at her thinking she can't even see. And she's making these incredible, incredible detailed weavings. Awesome. And she still has this tremendous sense of purpose. She's one of their most revered shamans. And she leads all of their ceremonies in worship to Pachamama and to the Apus, the mountains, their masculine and feminine god. I mean, really, really inspiring.
Now, Lissa, you're going to be joining us at the Longevity Conference. Maybe you want to give a sneak peek as to something that you're going to be presenting there that maybe is in the Fear Cure or isn't, that's really got you excited right now. You want to give us maybe a little teaser?
You know, in one of the things that I'm going to be talking about is what I call the 6 steps to cultivating courage. And, you know, it's one thing to kind of hear these worldview ideas, but what can you actually do? Like, what are the practical things that you can do to start to make that shift for yourself? And I'm going to be teaching some of those things so that, you know, it's not just an intellectual concept, but you start to actually have an experiential discovery process for yourself of what it would be like to transmute those fears, to let fear cure you so that you can open the soul cage and step to the other side. And it's so worth it because, you know, what lies on the other side is freedom.
It seems like this interesting phraseology that you're using, soul cage, is opening for us. And that's kind of happening on a cultural level. So I think the presentation and not only that, but your book as well is just so perfectly timed. And again, very symptomatic of a great book and great work that you're doing that's affecting us. And you're kind of riding a really interesting wave, a cultural wave that's happening, an undercurrent that's occurring. And I want to mention to everybody, I met Lissa at the Women's Wellness Conference and we just hit it off right away. This woman is just really cool and has such a great story. And Lissa, I'm just going to tell everybody that what was interesting about your story, it's also similar with Bruce Lipton and almost every other person in this field, is you had come to the banks of wreckage. You had come very, very close to complete failure and then brought yourself all the way to where you are today. And that's so important to understand because through that uncertainty, through the chaos, through the tsunami and the storm of it all, you remade your life and you changed your life. And I think that's a very strong metaphor for what we're all going through, and that we're landing on in a much better place, a place that's not superficial, right? This idea of like uncertainty is terrible. We got to get away from it. We got to go. No, actually, I like what Tony Robbins says. He says uncertainty is a need. You actually need it. It's a requirement of life, and then taking it on head on.
Thank you, David. I appreciate that. But one of the other things I'm going to be talking about, and this has been critical in my own life and all of the choices that I've had to make. I'm really fascinated these days about how we make choices. I might even write a book about that alone. Like, how do we make aligned choices that are tuned into what wants to be born in the world rather than what our ego is trying to create, but what wants to be born through us? And one of the ways that I've made those kinds of choices in the face of vast uncertainty is learning tools to be able to discern between what I call true fear and false fear. And 99.9% of our fears fall under the category of what I would call false fear, meaning, you know, your life is not in danger. There's not a tiger chasing you. You know, it's an imagined fear. It's a possible, you know, the mind imagining the worst thing that could possibly happen, and you're afraid of this potential outcome, but it exists only in the imagination, versus true fear, which is, you know, a survival mechanism. And even beyond that, I also put into the category of true fear, intuition. Because sometimes, you know, I have story after story. I interviewed hundreds of people for this book, and story after story of a woman, for example, who's walking out of her door, and she has a, you know, the baby's at home with the babysitter, and she's walking out the door, and she has a thought, I have to go check on the baby. The baby's room is on fire. Now, is that a paranoid thought, or is that intuition? Well, she goes into the baby's room, and the baby's room is on fire, and the baby's, she saves the baby, and the baby's fine. So what's that? Is that true fear or false fear, and how do we differentiate? So the book and what I'm going to be talking about at Longevity Now address some of those things. How do we discern between them so we can let true fear protect us while, you know, letting false fear cure us?
Dr. Lissa Rankin, everybody, you heard it here, The Fear Cure, also Mind Over Medicine, and she's working on a new book right now. Wanted to mention she's going to be at our Longevity Conference. Longevity Now this year is going to be held at the Anaheim Hilton, April 24th through 26th, 2015. You want to register now and get your hotel room now so that you don't get caught having to go to another hotel nearby. There's still plenty of rooms available, at least in this month of January, in order to get the hotel room in the hotel where the event's going to be. All the details are at longevityconference.com. And Lissa and myself and many other speakers are going to be presenting the latest and greatest. It's going to be a beautiful audio-visual presentation. It's going to be a brilliant weekend. Thank you so much, Lissa. Thanks for joining us. Any last words for our listeners?
You know, I just really hope for those of you who are dealing with fears of your own that you get to that point where you're willing and ready to kind of take that next step. You know, like I love the Martin Luther King Jr. quote that says that faith is taking the first step even when you don't see the whole staircase. Sometimes that's all it takes, is just deciding you're going to go to a conference and, you know, take that step for yourself to commit to allowing a transformation to happen within you. Because right now, with the way things are happening in our culture, we are all in service to the same thing, and it's happening through us, and we have to do it together.
Fantastic. And what a great place to do that, at the Longevity Conference. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. I'm David Avocado Wolf, signing off with Dr. Lissa Rankin, and we are wishing you the best day ever.